Well, welcome everybody, and welcome to this session, The Future of Financial Regulation in Australia. I thought I'd actually join our panellists down here on these comfortable seats for this session. These are indeed interesting times. In the years following the GFC, we've seen a tsunami of regulatory change sweep across the world, involving extensive regulation of financial institutions, financial products, markets, and in some ways, Australia has been spared from many of these changes, but with developments in technology, the world continues to become smaller, and as you know, regulators continue to seek to extend their reach across their borders. So if we look at Australia for the moment, we've obviously just passed a landmark point with the Financial System Inquiry, which is taking place in an environment 17 years since the Wallace Inquiry. And David Murray and his team have received over 270 submissions to date. They've been involved in apparently more than 100 stakeholder meetings and have the unenviable task of somehow bringing that all together into a coherent set of frameworks for the future. So I think you'll agree that the timing is ideal for this panel and a discussion on where Australia should be going forward. So each of our panellists brings a unique perspective to this debate, and we will spend the first half of this session or so in a discussion up here before taking questions from the floor. So without further ado, I'll hand to the panel and ask Lucy Ellis if you could give some comments and perspective, particularly on Australia in the context of the G20, and then moving on to the FSI.
Well, thanks for that, Jason, and thanks very much for having me. I think it is a big regulatory reform process. It involves a huge number of areas and a number of different regulators in each jurisdiction. But I think it's safe to say that the overall design of the regulatory reform process that we've seen since the crisis has been completely inspired by the lessons of the crisis and has been directed to the weaknesses and the things that we learned through the crisis. I mean, what are the things that we learned? I mean, banks needed to be safer. They needed more capital. They needed better quality capital. They needed better funding profiles. And that was a global picture. And at times when things did go wrong in a bank or another financial institution or infrastructure needed to be resolved, the resolution tools available needed to be more flexible. We needed to be able to resolve an entity and not have a full government bailout being the only option available to us. I think it's also the case that we needed to make sure that over-the-counter derivative markets were safer. I think there were a number of issues shown there, particularly in credit default swaps, but not only in credit default swaps, that over-the-counter derivative markets were not functioning with the level of safety that was needed in order for that particular market to serve its purpose. And I think also risk from shadow banking needed to be better understood and better managed. And, you know, when we think about how the crisis played out, I mean, in the end, there were a lot of banks that were in trouble, but a lot of it was due to the fact that they had related entities that were outside of the regulatory perimeter, that were where all the risks were and that were actually not being regulated or oversighted by anyone, including apparently the management of the overall financial group. And I think, you know, AIG, you know, built up enormous exposures in over-the-counter derivative markets in an unregulated, non-insurance part of its business. And they're the sort of things that are important in the shadow banking. And so those four headings, you know, safer banks, resolution, OTC derivatives and shadow banking are really the four key parts of the post-crisis regulatory reform, and they're the four key elements that Australia has emphasised as G20 in its G20 presidency year. And I think the view that we've taken has been there is actually an enormous program of work that has already been agreed. We should get on with completing that work, and we should have a very high bar for adding anything new to the agenda because, you know, it's nearly, that's what, more than 6 years now since the beginning of the crisis and coming up for 6 years since the peak of the crisis in 2008. And honestly, if you haven't thought of the idea yet, it probably wasn't that important. So I think the view of Australia as G20 presidency has been, this is what we've agreed to. It turns out some of that is an enormous amount of work, and there's a lot of very technical work that has to happen, you know, legal issues that have to be sorted out, data issues that have to be sorted out. I think that's been underappreciated. And so we want to get on with that and complete the work that we've already agreed. And I think that also, that view of the authorities in Australia also informs what we've said with the Financial System Inquiry. And, you know, if you look at the Reserve Bank submission, we, you know, one of the things we said was actually in Australia the arrangements of, you know, who does what is working pretty well. We have very good relationships. And we have already agreed to an awful lot of reforms, and that there are still a few bits and pieces that need to be completed on those. And so, you know, we would like to be allowed to get on with that and complete what's already been agreed.
Thank you. Technology was mentioned a few times, and data, just in terms of the pace of change and markets and so forth. I'd be interested in your views, Oliver, on technology in particular and how you cope with the pace of change.
Thank you, Jason. I think your point's a very valid one. We've seen an exponential growth in the complexity in the Australian financial marketplace, particularly over the last several years, and I think there are a couple of drivers sitting behind that. The technology is absolutely probably the main and primary driver. A number of regulatory decisions in particular have facilitated lowering the barrier of entry in addition to what technology is already providing, and has increased competition both in a domestic sense and in an international sense as well. And I think Lucy touched on something that's very real for us as an agency, regulating in the domestic context, but very much internationally, very much influenced internationally by what's going on overseas, and our capacity to introduce domestic settings that best serve investors and capital raisers in Australia, at the same time trying to manage our place in the international community and implementing change here that sits neatly with international expectations and those of our domestic community.
Would you like to comment?
Yeah, well, I would completely endorse what Oliver was saying, but if anything, if it's any comfort, Rebecca, I mean, we feel your pain in terms of the sort of the IT and regulatory change and what that means. And I think I can give, you know, two examples that even, you know, in the Reserve Bank, you know, we're having to, you know, spend lots of money and build big systems to deal with our side of the regulatory reform process. And I can think of two examples that are quite important. One is, of course, that, as you know, Australia simply doesn't have enough government debt to run the liquidity coverage ratio in the way it was originally designed. Fortunately, the Basel Committee was sensible enough to realise this, and you know, there is a particular element of the LCR rules that allow countries like Australia to use a committed liquidity facility with the central bank as an alternative to having a whole bunch of government bonds that simply aren't there as your liquid assets. Of course, that then means, you know, we need to think about what it is that we will accept in the committed liquidity facility. That then means, well, you know, some of the things we'd have to take, because there aren't enough government bonds, is self-securitisations. That means we need to comfort ourselves with the asset quality behind those self-securitisations. And that means we need loan-level mortgage data and a whole bunch of information. Well, of course, what does that mean? It's, you know, a ginormous database and a whole bunch of processes. And similarly, over-the-counter derivatives, one of the keystone elements of the post-crisis regulatory reform. I think one of the good things about the regulatory reform process that's happened globally is, you know, we haven't just said, oh, you know, we're going to write all these rules that say thou shalt do this, thou shalt not do that. It's not just been regulatory. A lot of it's actually been about reporting so that regulators can see the risks as they might arise, because we all know that the next crisis isn't going to look exactly like the last one. And so there's been a lot of focus, particularly in over-the-counter derivative markets, but also in shadow banking, around getting information. So, of course, you know, all of the over-the-counter derivatives, and, you know, Westpac will be one of the entities that are now reporting their over-the-counter derivatives exposures and transactions to trade repositories. Well, again, the reason for that is so that the regulators can actually see what's going on and work out if there are any risks that need to be responded to. Again, big, enormous database, huge numbers, you know, big IT spend. I mean, I think it's fair to say that both the industry and the regulators are facing this challenge at the moment, and technology and revamping your systems and doing it in the most efficient way possible is absolutely the priority on both sides, and I think there's a lot of synergies there. Of course, it means we're competing for the same staff.
With the time that we've got together here now, I'd actually like to spend some time on extraterritoriality, because I think that's going to be a big issue, or continue to be a big issue going forward. And I'd be interested in the panel's thoughts. I might start with you, Lucy, in terms of, you know, how you think we're coping with extraterritoriality as it's evolving and potentially where it might get to.
Thanks for that, Jason. I think the post-crisis regulatory reform agenda really was sort of the high point in international cooperation and standardisation for regulatory reform, and I think that was really what we should continue to aspire to. But it is the case that, well, firstly, there is a good principle that actually if countries want to be a little bit more conservative than what the global rules require, they should be allowed to do so. And, you know, in Australia, the authorities have always held to the principle that countries should be able to tailor appropriately to their national circumstances. And I think, again, the committed liquidity facility is an example of that. And so are some of the minor details within APRA's implementation of Basel III more broadly. But on the other hand, you know, you want to be able to offer substituted compliance. You want to be able to allow banks and other institutions to play in a global marketplace with some degree of certainty. And that means offering substituted compliance based on the global rules, what's been globally agreed, rather than saying, do you line by line, you know, accord with what we've done here in our country? Are your rules exactly the same as ours? And I think that's something that some of the countries globally haven't yet quite got to grips with. I think one of the other things is, of course, that within the countries that were most affected by the crisis, I think, you know, they have wanted to do more in terms of reforms. And, you know, it's interesting that when people complain about regulatory burden and all the re-regulation that's happened, it's like, well, what are the things that are really bothering you? And it's like, well, you know, FATCA and Dodd-Frank. And it's like, well, we can't really help you with those. You know, and in some respects, if you want to play in the US market, you have to play by US rules. If you want to play in the Australian market, you have to play by Australian rules. And I think finance is really the only industry that I'm aware of where, you know, as well as having technical standards that are sort of globally agreed, we're attempting to have regulatory standards that are globally agreed. I mean, you know, we're trying to have, you know, common standards around over-the-counter derivatives, but you don't have that for over-the-counter medicine. As anyone who's, you know, looked at the dosage requirements for lots of over-the-counter medicines, you know, we don't say, well, you know, here in Australia we'll take substituted compliance and take on what, you know, the UK NHS says, and, you know, at the risk of exposing a personal hobby horse, you know, we don't say what's good enough for Swedish babies is good enough for Australian babies, and we'll take the European child seat, you know, rules. Well, you know, I'm sorry, we've chosen quite a lot of safety at the expense of a certain amount of inconvenience in those areas. It's really finance is the only one, and anyone who's actually tried to switch one of those car seats over when you've had your car in repair shop, I mean, you know, now there's a regulatory reform I could, you know, really agree with, but, you know, finance is really the only area. We live in a globalised market. We have globalised supply chains right around the world. But every country has its own regulatory standards for pretty much everything else. Finance is the one industry where we go to all that effort to have globalised rules. And, you know, it doesn't always come out fully globalised. But I think the principle that substituted compliance should be offered on the basis of compliance with the global standard rather than the specific wording of your national regulation, I think, is an important one.
What do you think? Do the regulators do well enough talking to each other, or do we need a super regulator?
Well, my frequent flyer statement does say that we're doing a lot of coordination and talking to each other. I think it's an interesting idea, and obviously enforcement does require early access to data, and where I think the challenges in that idea come from are exactly the same challenges that we're facing on the OTC derivative space, where it's been acknowledged that, for example, we need a data hub internationally to look at the exposures of the globally systemically important banks and whether they're exposed to each other. There's different layers of, you know, national regulators get the national transactions and exposures, but other countries don't necessarily get that institution-level detail. But then there are processes for particularly the globally systemic institutions having exposures. And then there's a huge amount of legal change that has to happen to allow regulators in one country to allow that institution-specific information to be shared with other regulators. And so there's a huge program of work to actually allow that to happen. There's a special data room in Basel that's actually collating all these details. And, you know, it's actually hugely legally complex, and it requires legislative change in a number of countries. And, you know, just to give a perspective, you know, in Australia we can, you know, in particular APRA can give permission to other agencies to share data at an institution level with you know, internationally. And that's a lot of how, you know, things work with, you know, the Basel Committee process. You know, you have these quantitative impact statements. We do cost-benefit analysis that involves bank-level data. Again, confidentiality agreements have to be maintained. You're getting all that process, you know, and then, you know, it's very careful. You know, we then, you know, if there's, you know, someone from a research department of an international agency says, "Oh, it would be really cool if I could have that data and write journal articles using it," it's like, well, no, that's not what it's for. So there's a huge legal process to have that information sharing, and so I again, you know, the principle is really clear, but, you know, don't underestimate the legal hurdles. And, you know, you said maybe within 10 years.
Well, absolutely,
at least 10 years to get all that right.
Hi, I'd be interested in the panel's view on the current regulatory perimeter in Australia. Shadow banking's been mentioned a couple of times, but are there any particular areas of concern relevant to the Australian market, given where the boundary of the prudential net's currently drawn?
Yeah, taking up your point about shadow banking specifically, I think there are two related reasons why the global regulatory agenda has included an element of shadow banking. I mean, one is obviously the relationship between shadow banking and what went wrong in the GFC and cleaning up those specific things. But there's also a clear recognition that if you're doing a lot to make the prudentially regulated sector safer, you do risk overdoing it and then a lot of the activity moving out to the unregulated sector, and we have the 1970s all over again. And the global regulatory community is very aware of that, and I think that's where, you know, again, this is where about monitoring as well as regulation. So a lot of the regulatory reform that we're talking about is actually about getting more data, observing where the risks lie. In the Australian case, what you could reasonably describe as shadow banking, and particularly sort of the finance company, sort of money market corporation side of the picture, is actually really small and declining. And so we've always put the view in international forums that, again, the regulatory response should be proportionate to the risk. And so we've not had a lot of appetite to suddenly go in and, you know, re-regulate a whole bunch of things that really don't warrant it. And, you know, so, for example, you know, one of the things that went really wrong during the crisis was in the US, money market funds had runs. Well, the reason they had runs was because they were allowed to have a stable net asset value offered to customers, so they could give you a deposit-like instrument while not actually having deposit-like regulation. And in the Australian environment, that wasn't how it works. If you become illiquid, you have to freeze. Corporations Act says so, or the system, and this is, in Australia, the system worked because you couldn't get a run going on a non-deposit, you know, a non-ADI, because the way the Corporations Act works says, you know, you can't offer stable net asset value, you can't offer instant liquidity if you're not a deposit. And so we, our functional regulatory system actually worked and didn't have this kind of issue that the US had with its money market funds. Just the way the system was set up was different, and of course, you know, the equivalent space in Australia was much smaller in any case. But importantly, it was regulated differently. So we've always said it's got to be proportionate, but yeah, we're very alert to that.
Just got a question relating to macroprudential supervision, and in the context of high LVR limits imposed by the RBNZ in New Zealand, which by all accounts they seem to be relatively happy with the outcomes. Just wanted the panel's views on the prospects and merits of similar types of macroprudential supervision in this market.
Well, that one's kind of obviously mine, isn't it? The Reserve Bank and APRA have already put out their position on what macroprudential means in the Australian context. There's a paper that we put out in, what was that, 2012, which was also, you know, done in the context of the IMF FSAP. And, I mean, our view is that macroprudential is subsumed within our broader financial stability framework, and given that it contains the word prudential, we're talking about what APRA can do. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of people around and about saying, well, why won't the Reserve Bank do something? It's like, because they're APRA's powers. And APRA's perfectly capable of making macroprudential assessments. APRA has a mandate that is about the system and financial stability. I think that's not true for a number of other jurisdictions. There's been a lot of misconceptions about, well, you know, the problem was we had these prudential regulators that were microprudential and just focused on safety and soundness of individual institutions, and that's why they missed all these risks. I mean, the first problem with that view is, well, if the mandate's wrong, fix the mandate. And the second problem with that view is actually a lot of what went wrong in the US was actually microprudential failure. There was just a complete failure in lending standards and credit practices in the US in their mortgage market. So, you know, it's not clear to me that you actually needed a macroprudential viewpoint there. I don't necessarily want to get into specifically what the New Zealanders have done, other than to point out they have also raised interest rates, so it's going to be very difficult to disentangle what actually has had an impact on the housing market there in recent months. Was it the interest rates or was it the LVR limits? It's really hard to tell. And I guess the viewpoint that I would have is that your regulatory response or your policy response should be targeted to the risks you actually face. You know, if you have a headache, you do not bandage your arm. And so, I mean, certainly in Australia, we haven't actually seen, you know, we have data on this, and, you know, data is really important. There is an international language or statistical definitions on lending standards, and this is something that in Australia we've been very focused on and tried to rectify, and, you know, how very important it is for, you know, banks to report their, you know, their LVR stats that they do every quarter, and that APRA publishes and we draw graphs of in every financial stability review. And what that tells you is that actually there hasn't been an increase in high LVR lending in Australia. So if you're concerned about risks in your market, look at the things that actually appear to be, you know, growing in the risk that they pose. And in the specific circumstances in Australia, high LVR lending, you know, you may take a view that it ought to be lower, but it's not something that has been increasing in risk. So were we to consider a particular regulatory response or policy response to a risk in property markets generally, a high LVR limit is not the one that would seem most calibrated to the kind of risks we face in Australia at this point. But again, this would be a judgment by APRA, and there are a number of different tools in its toolkit. This has been discussed publicly in a number of other places. I mean, I know the Governor mentioned in one of his recent public appearances that, you know, we have thought about how to do this. You know, check our FOI disclosure logs for some of the things that we've said and that I've said about this. But, you know, you should really look at the kinds of things that are actually, the risks that are actually being posed. So yeah, I think that would summarise it. But we've said a number of things about that publicly already.